close enough to 9 o'clock. We're going to get started. I know we're probably going to be a little bit low in number this morning because some folks brought their kids, and I'm sure they went home to change, sleep, whatever. But we're going to go ahead and start and work our way through this portion of Exodus. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for this morning and for the opportunity you've given us to be together. Lord, I thank you for your word and for the truth we find there. I thank you for the encouragement and the challenge that we get from your word. I pray you would help us again as we walk through these things that Israel is walking through, that we wouldn't stand as judges over them, but that we would recognize our own propensity to do those same kinds of things, and that we'd be challenged not to live that way. We'd be challenged to trust you in the middle of difficulty because we know that you will answer and you will deliver. Thank you for just the encouragement we get from your truth. We ask this in your name, amen. Just to make sure you all understand, I know I didn't miss the bus. I am speaking at teen camp, but I'm going tomorrow. I could use this day here more than I could driving in a bus, sleeping overnight to get there the rest of the way. So I'm going out tomorrow. I'm leaving about 3 o'clock in the morning and driving out. I didn't miss the bus. I know where we are. We are in Exodus right now. We stopped last week and we were talking about manna. Remember, there are three things. Is we're right now on the way to Sinai, right? That's where we are right now. We're on the way to Sinai. We've crossed the sea. We've gotten there. We're really, Egypt is now in the rearview mirror completely, no longer a threat at all, except for the fact, the wrong idea or the wrong memories that Israel is going to develop regarding Egypt and their desire to go back there. But as far as an oppressive nation, Egypt is now kind of out of the picture. And now we're now all focusing on what God is doing for Israel. And as he's walking them from the sea to Sinai, he's going to give them a series of tests. And the series of tests are designed, there's an individual design in each one of the tests. Like with the thirst and the bitter water, we learned last week that was a test to show them the difference between the bitterness of Egypt and the sweetness of following God. That was the design of that one. We're in manna right now, and there's a test in manna as well. There's a test for that, and so each individual one seems to have a test that God stretches out there. But beyond that, there's a general idea, general thing we can learn from all of them together. And I talked about that last week. There are three things that I think that as we walk through these with Israel, there are three principles I think that we can take for ourselves. And those three principles, again, are difficulty is really difficulty. No one of these difficulties is something that could have been just winked away or said it's not a real problem. Thirst is a real problem. 3 days without good water is a real problem. It's not something they made up. It is a real deal. Not having food or the perception of being hungry is a real problem. That's a real problem. It's not something they made up. Again, the next one we get to is going to be water again, a lack of water. They're going to be thirsty again, and that's a real problem. An army coming out against you. That's a real problem. So all of these things were real issues, not made up, not just imagined issues for them. So difficulty was difficulty. So whatever it is that we're facing, whatever it is that we're going through, we don't need to minimize the difficulty. I think sometimes in minimizing the difficulty, we minimize God's work and we minimize God's hand in that and what God's trying to do. So first of all, difficulty is difficulty. Second thing is, I'm here because God wants me here. Remember, the fact is that what's leading them where they're being led is a pillar of cloud and a pillar of fire, and they are following that, and God is actually leading them where they're going. He's the one that led them for 3 days without water. He's the one that's going to lead them to think they don't have enough food. He's going to lead them to another place with no water. He's going to lead them to the Amalekites. He's going to do all this stuff, and I don't think he's accidentally doing it. I don't think it's, oh, I shouldn't have gone that way. No, he's got a plan that he's leading them through. He's leading them through all these things, and God has them exactly where he wants them to teach them about himself, to teach them who he is, and to provide them opportunities to trust him to deliver them. That's the second thing. God has me exactly where he wants me. The third is God can and will deliver. God can and will deliver. In each one of these situations, God is the one who delivers. Not in every situation, it's done so that the answer is given so that it clearly has to be God. It can't be explained away as anything else. God's the one who steps in, and God's the one who delivers them and makes a way and overcomes the obstacle, whatever that obstacle is. He overcame the bitter water last time. He overcame the bitter water by showing Moses the log that he throws into the pool, and it becomes sweet water. I don't know of any kind of I read a lot of folks trying to rationalize or minimize the supernaturalness of that miracle. I just don't think you can do that. He's going to do it with manna. He's going to do it with water from a rock. He's going to do it with an amazing victory over the Amalekites. He's going to do it over and over and over again. He's going to show them that he is, in fact, trustworthy. He can be trusted, and he is going to deliver them. So those are the lessons that are being taught to Israel. That's the overwhelming lesson from all of these things in the middle of individual tests. And I think that's what, as you read, it's easy as you read this to get to the point where you're really tired of Israel. And maybe in your yearly Bible reading, when you get to this part of Exodus, you're just, oh, come on, can't you get it? And so rather than reading and be frustrated with Israel, I would hope that we would read this and be challenged in our own life, that we wouldn't respond that way, but that we would see in these situations that difficulty is difficulty, that God has them exactly where they want them, and he will deliver. Same goes for us. Same goes for us. Difficulty is really difficulty, but God has us exactly where he wants us, and he is the one who will deliver. He is the one who will deliver. I think a lot of it ends up in how we approach him. Sometimes we approach him the way that Israel approached him, with the whining, why have you led us here, Moses? And God, Moses goes to God saying, are you going to fix this? I mean, there's a real difference in how each group approaches God, and I think that's displayed very well throughout here. So last week we spent most of the Sunday morning talking about Mara, or the bitter waters. Today we're going to finish up manna and move on to more water. So we're in manna right now. And so what happened is, after they got through the water, they went and they're in the plains of Elam. They've really enjoyed it there. Life has been great for them there. They've had a great time. Spent a couple weeks there at least, probably closer to 3 weeks there. They've been there at that pool, at that oasis with the 12 pools, 12 springs, 70 palm trees. They have just really been enjoying themselves there. But then the pillar moves. The pillar gets up and moves. And when that pillar gets up and moves, that means they got to get up and move too. And so now they're leaving there. And I think that's part of the problem. Part of the problem is they've actually, when you're someplace for 3 weeks, you start getting comfortable, especially when what you need is there. When what you need is there, when there's water there, when there is shade there, when there is protection from the elements there, this could be very comfortable. And it could be, wow. And think about it. In Egypt, they were making bricks all the time. Here they are sitting by an oasis, sitting by a pool, sitting by 12 springs and 70 palm trees, and they're just enjoying life. They've never been in a situation like this ever before, and I'm sure this to them feels like paradise. Feels like paradise, but it's not the promised land. It's not the promised land. The promised land is still a good ways off, and they've got to get there. They've got to get there. So they move away from there, and I think there's probably some disappointment when you leave someplace that I mean, you know, look at Jonah. Jonah who goes out and sits on the side of a hill to watch Nineveh, and he's getting scorched by the sun, and God grows up a plant, right? God grows up a plant, and in just a matter of days, Jonah falls in love with that plant. And I'm not making that up. I'm not over-exaggerating Jonah's feelings for that plant, because when the plant dies, Jonah is heartbroken. How did you do this to my plant? What happened to my plant? It's not right that you did this to my plant. And so now expand that by 2 million and think of how comfortable they were in that area where they were, and now they're being told, you got to leave. And And it wasn't you got to leave and you're going to go someplace that's just as nice. No, they're going to leave and they're going to go into a wilderness where they have no real provision of food. And so they start to get hungry. They start to get hungry. And so they grumble against God. They grumble against God. In chapter 16, verse 3, the people say, "And the people of Israel said to them, 'Would that we have died by the hand of the Lord in Egypt, when we sat by the meat pots and ate bread to the full, for you brought us into the wilderness to kill us whole assembly with hunger.'" So again, we talked about that last week. They are so discontent that they actually say, "We wish the plagues would have hit us in Egypt. Just like they got Egypt, we wish they would have hit us too." Because they don't say, "Would that we just would have died." They say, "Would that we would have died by the hand of the Lord." So they're actually wishing the plagues upon themselves is what they're wishing for, which is drastic, drastic hunger. I think in that statement, there's quite a bit of disappointment. So Moses then goes before God. We talked about this last week. And God answers by saying, "I'm going to provide for you this stuff called this thing to gather." He doesn't call it manna. God doesn't call it manna. Because God knows what it is, he wouldn't call it manna. But the people don't know what it is, and so they call it manna. And we talked about last week, the word manna means, what is it? What is it? Again, there have been several attempts to explain this naturally, but nothing naturally explained will do exactly what happened with the manna. So if you recall, they were to go out, they would wake up in the morning, and the ground would be covered with dew. And when the dew dried up, it would leave behind this residue, this flaky kind of residue that was like a wafer, but it was very sweet. And so they would go out and they would gather that. 6 days a week they would gather. 5 days they'd gather enough for that day. On day six they'd gather enough for 2 days. That was God's plan for them because he's already protecting the Sabbath. He's already for them protecting the Sabbath, even though the Sabbath law has not been given yet. Okay, they're not going to get the Sabbath law until they hit Exodus 20, until they get down to Sinai. That's when they get the law. That's when they get the Sabbath. But he's already protecting the Sabbath, even before they get there. That's a pretty big deal. Pretty big deal. It's very important to him, even in providing manna before they get there. He already says, "But on the sixth day you gather twice as much, because you're not going to gather on the seventh." I'm not going to gather on the seventh. So that's the plan. And so now he understands that man can't live on bread alone or manna alone. So every night then, look at verse 13. "In the evening, quail came up and covered the camp. In the morning, dew lay around the camp. And when the dew had gone up, there was on the face of the wilderness a fine flake-like thing, fine as frost on the ground." So every evening, they didn't have to go out and get this. Every evening, quail would just come in and land right in front of them. That's what you call easy quail hunting right there. It just flops right in front of you. Didn't have to walk a field. You didn't have to have a dog to scare them up. Nothing like that. There they were, quail. Now, we're going to get quail in a little bit. After a bit, we're going to get a lot of quail. But this was enough for them to have meat for the evening. So they would eat meat in the evening. They would eat their quail as it came up. And in the morning, they would then have manna. They would get manna. And they were to go out each day and gather enough manna for the day. And if they left manna in their pot until the next day, when they woke up in the morning and opened their manna pot, it would smell terrible. It would stink, and it would have worms. So it would be inedible. They could not eat it. They could not eat it for the next day. They'd have to pour that out and go gather more manna. So it wasn't like they could store up manna. I think there's even a lesson in that. That's daily trusting God. I think that's in mind when God says, "Give us this day our daily bread." That is, the manna is a picture of that daily bread, that daily dependence upon God for that day's sustenance. Because they couldn't store it up. They couldn't can it. They couldn't freeze it. They couldn't, was a vacuum packet. They couldn't do any of that kind of stuff. They couldn't put salt on it to somehow preserve it that way. It was every day they had to rely upon God to provide for them every day. So it's going to end up lasting 40 years. It wasn't, first of all, designed to be 40 years, right? I mean, they were supposed to get up to Kadesh Barnea and go in the land. It would have been done at that point. But because of their disobedience, it lasts for 40 years that God does this. God does this manna for them. So that's what they were supposed to do, except on day six. Day six, they were supposed to go out, and they were supposed to gather twice as much. So every Friday morning, they would go out, and they would gather twice as much as they needed, because miraculously, that manna, the leftover manna on day six, when they woke up on day seven, it was fine. It was edible, it was still sweet, it didn't stink, and it didn't have worms. But not only that, on day seven, no manna would come. No manna would fall on the earth. It wouldn't happen. And this is a test. This test is specifically designed to see if Israel would obey that law. This is what the test is. We know that because of what is said. Look at verse 27. Now, I should start at verse 22. On the sixth day, they gathered twice as much bread, two omers each. When all the leaders of the congregation came and told Moses, he said to them, "This is what the Lord has commanded. Tomorrow is a day of solemn rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you will bake and boil what you will boil. And if there's any left over, lay aside to be kept till morning." So he laid it aside till morning as Moses commanded, and it did not stink, and there were no worms in it. And Moses said, "Eat it today, for today is a Sabbath to the Lord. Today you will not gather, not find it in the field. 6 days you will gather it, but on the seventh, which is a Sabbath, there will be none." But Israel, being Israel, thought, "Well, we had some left over from last night. Let's go get us some more. Verse 27, "On the seventh day, some of the people went out to gather, but they found none. And the Lord said to Moses, 'How long will you refuse to keep my commandments? See, the Lord has given you the Sabbath. Therefore, on the sixth day, he gives you bread 2 days. Remain each of you in his place. Let no one go out of his place on the seventh day.' So the people rested on the seventh day." So this is actually a test to see if Israel would obey God's rule here. It was a test to see if Israel would obey and respond in obedience to what God had said about not gathering on the seventh day, or about gathering twice as much on day six, so you have it for day seven. And Israel, a portion of Israel, failed the test because they got up on day seven and went out to try to find manna. And guess what? They found none, because there was none out there. There was no manna out there for them to find, because it didn't happen on day seven. It didn't fall on day seven. And that's, I think, speaks to some of the supernaturalness. I think I'm making that word up, but the supernatural aspect of this answer. Because there's no reason that anything would go 6 days, double on the sixth day, and then nothing on the seventh. There's nothing naturally occurring that we know of that when you put it in a bowl and you keep it overnight, it stinks and then gets worms. There's nothing in that area that does that. That's something that's significant. Actually, God is going to tell Moses to get an omer of the stuff and keep that omer. And this an omer is, by the way, an omer is a tenth of an ephah. I have no idea what that means. I have no idea how much an ephah is. I have no idea how much an omer is. Okay, I know omer pi. No. I don't know how much an omer is, but we do know, we're given this indication at the end of this, that an omer is a tenth of an ephah, okay? So, I don't know, bushel, peck, whatever you got. But anyway, there's a jar of manna that Moses was said to go get, and Aaron was supposed to go get, and they were supposed to keep that as a testimony throughout all the generations of Israel. So I fully believe, and I might be wrong, I might be proven wrong when I get to heaven, but wherever the Ark of the Covenant is right now, wherever it is, there's a pot of manna. That pot of manna is inside of it, and that pot of manna is still good today. It's still good today. That when it gets opened, if it gets opened, the people of Israel would be able to eat that manna as if it were fresh the day they picked it up. I really believe that, because it was supposed to serve as a testimony of what God had done. And that word testimony is really important. The word testimony is really important because it was supposed to be one of those things that Israel looked back and said, you see what God did for us? You see what God did for us? God, we were hungry in the wilderness, and God miraculously provided for us a special kind of food that no one has ever had before and no one has ever seen since. Why do I say it's something never seen before or never had since? Well, because when the quail came, they called it quail, right? When quail came up in the evening, guess what they called it? Quail. Why is that? Because they knew what quail was, and quail was naturally occurring. Quail's a naturally occurring bird. And God doesn't tell them. Now, it is miraculous the way they came and just flopped down, all right? That's miraculous. The fact that quail would come and fall at your feet, covering the camp, that's pretty amazing. Well, maybe that was just a place where quail happened to come, okay? It followed them for 40 years that way. And wherever they went, you know, maybe they had these special lights that like attracted insects, but these attracted quail. I don't know what it was. But wherever they went, the quail came to them. That's a miracle, but it's a naturally occurring bird. And they're not told, and by the way, put two quail in that pot too. They're not told to do that. So there is some sense of miraculous in the quail, but there's something really special about the manna. Because manna was just for them. Just for them. I mean, think about this. No one since that generation of Israel, no one except those two generations of Israel, the one that died in the wilderness and the one that first entered the land, no one else has ever tasted manna, ever. It's pretty unique deal. Pretty special thing God did, and he wanted them to have that as a testimony to say, look what God did for us. When we were hungry, he provided. And he's going to say, and he provided for 40 years. For 40 years, he provided this for them as they walked through the wilderness. So manna is a special gift of God's provision and a test to see, will you keep my commandments? How'd they do? They failed. They failed. Not all of them. Some of them failed, okay? Because it doesn't say all of them. It says the seventh day, some of the people went out to gather, but they found none. So, yeah, Ron? Oh, three sayas. Okay. Okay. Ron says an ephah is equivalent to a bushel. So the tenth of a bushel is how they got to eat that much. All right. So that's manna. What's the individual lesson? Individual lesson is this: they were really hungry. No doubt about that. They were really hungry. God led them to that hunger as a test to see if they would obey him or not. They failed the test. God still provided for them. And what I find interesting is over and over and over again, up until Numbers 13, God gives them a test. There's a real serious difficulty that is really difficulty. They seem to fail the test, even though God led them there. And in every situation, God provides for them and meets their need until Kadesh Barnea, when they refuse to go in the land. And that's why I think all this is building up to that. All of these things are building up to Kadesh Barnea, when they're going to be faced with the decision, do we go in and face these giants or do we not? And God is over and over and over again showing them through the wilderness that I can overcome whatever the obstacle is. I can overcome that. You don't have to. And they still say, no, we're not going in. And that's when God says, I'm done. And that generation then is going to die in the wilderness. It's going to take them 40 years to do it, but that's what is going to happen. So that's manna. So they've had a lesson about thirst. Failed in that lesson, but God provided water, sweet water, from bitterness to sweet. They had a lesson about hunger, and they failed the test about hunger, but God provided them for them anyway. Well, we're going to get a thirst test again, Okay, we're not done with thirst. We're going to get more thirst. Chapter 17, we have Massa and Meribah are the two names given to this place because of the quarreling that they had and because they doubted God. They put him to the test. Those are the things. So Massa means quarreling and Meribah means putting him to the test. They put God to the test. Yes. Yeah, that's a good question. Mike said that there's no indication that, as far as we know, that they supplemented their diet with their own livestock. No, there's not. There's no indication they supplemented. And I thought through that myself. I was wondering why do they even need? Why didn't they just kill their stuff? I think the carnage left by 2 million people eating. Sacrificing and killing and eating every day would have been a mess. Not only that, at some point you're going to run out. At some point you're going to run out of food when you're feeding 2 million people for 40 years. I don't know why they were not supposed to or not to sacrifice or use their own livestock. Probably might have been part when they got in the land they would need that. I'm not sure. But there's no indication ever at all that they had anything except quail and manna. In fact, later on, they're going to be, if they were supplementing, it doesn't account for the response of, all we have is this manna. You know, later on, we're going to get there, they're going to actually, we are so sick of manna, give us meat. And God had been giving them meat every day. They'd been getting meat every day. I think it's the original chicken and a biscuit. You know, you get quail and you get honey-flavored wafers, which, why would you eat that? But he'd been given to me, but they wanted meat. And so God gives them meat. And they're so thrilled about all this quail. I mean, it says that, we'll get there, but it says that the quail was, you know, waist high quail, just flopping over and dying. And they're eating, and they're so happy about the quail. Then God says, okay, now it's going to happen. And it starts coming out their nose. They got sick of quail. But so he gave them meat all the time. But as far as supplement, there's no indication that they were supposed to eat anything else. And I think there's an indication they didn't because of their response to the manna later on about all we have is this crazy manna stuff. So good question. Any other questions before I jump ahead? I should have stopped and asked. Dave.
So you think that the quail was also perpetual just like the manna was?
Seems to be. Yeah, well, so they claimed not to have meat, okay? They claimed, but again, let's think about them. Let's think about their complaints a little bit. Let's go back to how they even complained about when they were hungry, okay? Oh, that we were in Egypt. Remember what we did all day? When we sat by the meat pots and ate bread to the full. That is not what happened. That is not what they were doing in Egypt. In Egypt, they were slaves. They spent their day making bricks. They came home to probably a meager portion of food and very little bread, all right? But in their mind, when we sat by the meat pots, right? So I don't know that Israel has a very good job of explaining accurately what's really going on. And so when they're calling for meat, maybe they don't think they're getting enough meat, and I think that's probably what's going on. They're not thinking that because... God's going to send them a lot of meat. I think that's probably the issue, is we're not getting enough meat, is what I think is at mine. And so in their mind, not getting enough means we're not getting any. So that's how I would explain that. It seems very clear that in the evening, quail come to the camp, and in the morning, dew lay around the camp. So it seems it's the same kind of a thing in the evening, in the morning. The man was there every morning, so I'm guessing, I think the quail was there every night. Larry Balk.
You've answered my question.
Okay. Chris Bell. Yeah. True, yeah. It's immaturity. Yeah, get used to it. get used to it. They're going to grumble and grumble and grumble and grumble. And get used to it in your own life, too, because you're going to grumble and grumble and grumble and grumble. Dave, did you have your hand up, Dave? Oh, I thought your hand went up. I thought, okay, all right. Good stuff, good stuff. And so the reason I think quail's perpetual is because of that in the evening and in the morning. And so in the morning, the manna was a perpetual thing. It's in the same sense that in the evening. It doesn't actually say that quail came every day. Okay? So I'll get that out there. I think it came every day. I think it came every day. Moving on. Chapter 17, one of the most famous stories of the Exodus. Water from the rock the first time. Let's read. All the congregation of the people of Israel moved on from the wilderness of Sin by stages, according to the commandment of the Lord, and camped at Rephidim. But there was no water for the people to drink. Therefore the people quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water to drink." And Moses said, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord?" But the people thirsted for water, and the people grumbled against Moses and said, "Why did you bring us up out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?" So here's the deal. They've traveled now. They're in Rephidim, and there's no water, and they're thirsty again, and they start grumbling against Moses again. And suddenly it's now Moses' fault again. Moses, why are you doing this? Again, if I'm Moses, I'm pointing to the pillars and say, I am not doing this. I am merely being obedient to what God is doing for me. And he does, in a sense, do that. He does, in a sense, do that this time. They say, "What are you doing to us, Moses?" And he says, "Why are you quarreling with me? I didn't do this." He kind of said that when he and Aaron kind of said it when they're grumbling about the food, no food. He said, "What are we? We can't provide food. Why are you grumbling? Why are you quarreling with us?" So he says it again. "Why are you quarreling with me? Why are you quarreling with me? And why are you testing God? Why are you testing God?" But the people wouldn't hear that. People wouldn't hear that. They didn't want to hear, okay, yeah, we should respond to God and say, "Hey, God, provide us water, please. Yahweh, you provided, you gave us water before, you gave us food before, we're out of water now, guess who we should trust for water? Because you led us here, now provide water." They don't do that. They're so thirsty that they again grumble against Moses. And now it gets down to, why did you bring us out of Egypt? To kill us here? To kill us and our children and our livestock from thirst? Is that your plan, Moses? Is that your master plan, Moses? And now Moses responds and cries out to God, "What shall I do with this people? What am I going to do with these people?" This is the first time he said, "What am I going to do with these people?" He's actually at some point going to call them, "What am I doing with this stubborn and stiff-necked people?" At some point, it's funny when you see, like Moses gets the end of his rope and God says, "No, you're not the end of your rope. It's going to be fine." And at some points, God gets the end of his rope and says, "I'm done." And Moses says, "No, you can't be done." They're kind of helping each other through this difficult situation with these difficult people. He says, they are almost ready to stone me. So God says to Moses, the Lord said to Moses, "Pass on before the people, taking with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on a rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water shall come out of it, and the people will drink." So God says, "I got this. Take the staff, take some of the elders of Israel with you, go to Horeb, strike the place that I tell you to strike where I am, and water will gush forth from that rock, and you will have water to drink, the people will drink." So Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel and called the name of the place Massah and Meribah because of the quarreling of the people, because they test the Lord by saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" Yeah, Larry.
I know this is kind of a dumb question. Let me just say, yes, I believe it happened. Okay, but where it says, "And the Lord said that I will stand before you there on the rock,"
That's a good question. That's a good question. I think it's either one of two things. It's either a burning bush kind of moment where there's that kind of a thing going on here that's specific, or it's the pillar has moved to that place and led Moses to that place. One of those two. I would probably lean more toward the pillar at this point, because that seems to be how God is leading the people right now, is through the pillar of smoke and the pillar of fire. So my guess is that pillar has gone to before Moses and stopped at the place where he's supposed to hit. But it could very possibly be, because God has done this for Moses before, could very possibly be a burning bush kind of thing where Moses sees something that clearly indicates this is a special place where God is. It's one of those two. But yes, it clearly is some kind of a, it's not just Moses walked and, oh, pop, it wasn't that. It was God led him to the place, and God says that he would stand before him. So in some sense, God is standing before him on that place, on that rock. So yeah, one of those two ways. One of those two ways. I don't necessarily think that, you know, it was the pre-incarnate Jesus standing there in that form. I don't think that, but I there was some indication by God that this was the place. This was the place, and he was himself was present there. He himself was present there. Yeah, Mike.
Does the word behold in that sentence add
behold? I think when God says behold, it means stand back, pay attention. Okay? So I think what God is doing is again, teaching a lesson here, something they were supposed to get. This is not just, I'm not just giving you water. I'm not just giving you water here. And I think that's the response of Israel is, hey, we got water. You know, the response of Israel at Massa was, hey, or Mara was, hey, we got sweet water. The response of Israel when they were hungry was, hey, we got food. And God doesn't want them just to say, hey, we got that. God wants them to see, I have provided for you. I have led you here, and I have provided for you in the midst of your difficulty. I provided. So behold, I'm doing this. So I think that's what behold stands for. It means whenever God says behold, it means pay attention, stand back and see everything here, not just what's the obvious. I think that's the behold going on there. And that's what he's trying to do. He's trying to get them to see deeper than just the outward fix. Yeah, Larry.
I know we've kind of mentioned this before a little bit, but are we at another one of these points where all those millions of people are giving Moses the credit for what's going on rather than God himself?
Yeah, well, yes. And here's why. Because they're actually, the quarrel is, the test is, that's why it's called Meribah. They put God to the test, and they're asking the question, is he even among us? Is he even among us? So what's the indication? Is the indication, Moses, what are you doing? What are you doing this for? So yes, I think there's this is one of the times when this is all on Moses, and because of who they grumble against? They grumble against Moses. And Moses says, why are you quarreling against me, and why do you grumble against God? That was Moses' words, not their words. Their words were, what'd you bring us out here for, Moses? What'd you bring us out here for, Moses? What are you doing? And that's where Moses says, you put God to the test by saying, is he even among us? Is he even in this? By the way, how'd they get out of Egypt? How'd they get out of Egypt? Was it just a series of unpleasant events for Egypt that finally they said, no, go? No, clearly God had led them and gotten them out of Egypt. How'd they get across the sea? Clearly God got them across the sea. How had they gotten sweet water? God had done that. How had they gotten manna? God had done that. And yet now, where's God? Where's
God?
Well, exactly. They, Mike said, they gave him credit in the song. Let's go back. Moses gives him credit in the song. Moses writes a song. They sing along. They sing along with Moses. I don't think that's a heartfelt song for them, because it's not too much longer that they say, what are you doing? Remember, it's funny. As they get across the Red Sea or the sea, what do they say? It says, verse 14, last verse of 14, So the people feared the Lord, and they believed in the Lord and in his servant Moses. Last time you're going to see that. Last time you're going to see that is when they feared the Lord and they believe in the servant Moses, what you're going to see the rest of the wilderness wandering is them grumbling against Moses and disregarding God. Disregarding God. That's where they fall to. And so what you said, Mike, is important, because we often do the same thing. Our memories are so short regarding what God has done for us. Our memories are so short regarding the things he's taken us through and who he is. And oftentimes we stand at a difficulty and we say, God, are you even in this? Where are you at all? So yes, there is a great lesson for us to learn there. J.D.? Yes. J.D. asked, in the Egyptian culture that day, was it common for the gods to be an everyday object always around the people? And the answer to that is absolutely yes. The reason that's absolutely yes is because everything was tied to a god. Everything was tied to a god. There was a god of the Nile. That's where they got all of their water. That's where they really got life from. The sun, Ra, was a god. Everything they saw every day, there's a god of the air. There's a god of dust. There's a god of flies. There's a god of fleas. You know, there's a god of cows. There's a god of all this stuff. There's a livestock god. So yeah, everything was associated with a god in some sense. That would have been a normal understanding for the Egyptians. Now, I'm not sure how much Israel bought into that necessarily. I'm not sure how much Israel bought into that, but we know I think there's an indication they bought into some of it, because when they get to Sinai and Moses is gone for 40 days, they tell Aaron, build us a god like we had back in Egypt. Build us a god like that. So I think they had some kind of a buy-in to that, maybe not to the same level that all the Egyptians did, but there was some type of buy-in there, just because of their own response when they think Moses is gone. Did I see another hand somewhere? Mike? In their case, seeing is definitely believing. That in their case, that's definitely, yeah. So what is that not? It's not faith. It's not faith. And I think that's a clear indication. It's not faith. And I said this like several weeks ago, that I believe all this generation lacked faith. And I don't think we'll see any of this generation except Moses, Aaron, Miriam, potentially, and Joshua and Caleb. I don't think we'll see any except those five in heaven. I don't think we'll see any of them. The reason I don't think we'll see any of them is because Hebrews tells us we won't. Book of Hebrews says all these died without getting to the rest. And the book of Hebrews in chapter 4 is not talking about the rest of the promised land. It's talking about the rest that God provides in salvation. And all these people didn't make it. So these people had no faith. And so when you said, yeah, seeing is believing, exactly for them, because they had no faith in God. They had no faith in God. Okay. Okay. 9:42. Ron, go ahead.
Yeah, I think one thing to keep in mind is that when they were living in Egypt, the God that they saw every day was the Pharaoh.
Yeah.
And now they're out of Egypt. Who's their Pharaoh, essentially? It's Moshe. And they're probably looking at him. And I think that's probably why they're expecting, why they grumble against him more than against God.
That's a good point. That's a good point. In Egyptian culture, Pharaoh was considered God, a god. He was really the visible god on earth for Egypt. And so that's potentially, like Ron just suggested, that's potentially why they grumbled against Moses, because the visible representation, except for the pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire that's right there as well, the visible representation and what they would have assumed living-wise was Moses was the one who was God. But Moses never claimed to be God. Moses never said he was in the place of God. Moses always pointed to God being God, not him being God. Pharaoh would have claimed to be God. Pharaoh was fine with being God. That's why it was a big deal when his son died, his firstborn died, and he couldn't bring him back to life. That was a big deal. That's what finally put them out, because it recognized, I think Egypt recognized, he's no God. He's a man just like we are. He could overcome Israel's God, Yahweh. All right? We have 1 minute, so I'm just killing time because there's no way I'm going to start the next thing for a minute. So, Mike, go ahead. It's got to be. Well, so no, Jesus does say, and there are several things he does in his walk on earth. There are several things he does while he's here to demonstrate so that the disciples and others could see who he was. Okay, that's clear. And I think that John 17 is high priestly prayer. Jesus prays for those who have seen and believed, but he also prays for those who will not see and yet believe. I think he prays for them as well. And seeing is believing, but seeing is and believing is not faith. And there's always an idea of faith. There's always an idea of faith. The disciples have to have faith. Yeah, they had to have faith. Faith in what? Faith that he's going to raise from the dead. That's what they struggled with. Remember, Jesus at least 3 times told his disciples, I'm going to Jerusalem. I'm going to be delivered to the chief priest, and I'm going to die. I'm going to rise again the third day. And every situation, every time he does that, they kind of blow him off. They kind of blow him off. First, Peter says, nuh-uh, not going to happen. The second time, they start quarreling. Who's going to be first in the kingdom? You know, after he tells them that, then James and John's mom comes up and says, hey, my kids can be right there by you. Think you can do that? John says that at one point when he says that they didn't get it until after he was risen. So even they needed some measure of faith. So faith's always important. But he did stuff on the earth so that he could be seen as God for who he is. Absolutely, he did that. That doesn't negate faith, however. These people could have seen what God did and said, okay, now we have faith, now we trust, and approach God in an area of trust would have been demonstrated at Kadesh Barnea when they said, go into the land. Even though there are giants in there, go in. And they could have said, no, we have faith. God is going to do what he said he's going to do. We're going to go in. They didn't do that. Joshua and Caleb did.
I would think God would be more mad. Of course, but I don't know. But I think I decently understand why he doesn't let him go in when he doesn't obey him at the rock the second time in the water. But it seems like Joshua and Caleb were, they're the ones who got it. God saw it. And Moses, like, Moses and Aaron just kind of.
Well, No, I think Moses got it. I think Moses was a man like we are, and when you spend years and years and years and years and years with people, and they've seen God do, and they just don't get it, at some point you say, oh, come on, seriously? And I think Moses, in anger, just steps up, and he just is so sick of things, he hits that rock. It's a pride issue, but I think it's an anger issue, and it's not a seeking God issue. But I would not suggest that Moses buckled at all. I think, especially reading Deuteronomy, I recognize Moses. I think Moses got it till the end and still gets it. I really do. Really do. Yep. All right, it's now 9:48. So let me pray and then we'll get ready for church. Lord, thank you for the truth of your word. Thank you for the encouragement we find there. Thank you for the challenge that I find there of really trusting you through difficulty. Give us grace as we walk today. We ask this in your name. Amen. You're dismissed. Thanks.